From deep inside Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Larry Osterman.
And I'm Andrew Richards.
And welcome to Defrag Tools.
And tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a 29-year veteran now?
Pretty close, yeah. Next month I hit 29.
Wow.
It's funny, I come in and it's no longer the kids who are coming in, the new hires weren't born when I... No, it's now, you know, oh, I was 5 years at Microsoft when they were born.
Yeah. Oh.
It makes you feel old.
And what was the first thing you worked on?
I worked on multitasking MS-DOS 4.0.
Wow.
A product that nobody, except for a bunch of people in France, ever saw.
Really?
Yeah, it was intended to be a mainline version. It was the next version of DOS after DOS 2. It's complicated, but there was the next version after DOS 2, and we were going to build it, and we were very proud of it. It was a real old multitasking operating system. It was the next thing in DOS. And then we got this joint development agreement with IBM, and we totally shifted gears, and we said, okay, you know what, this DOS thing, it's nice, but let's build a real operating system that's protected mode, that allows access to more than 640, 50K of memory. Let's build something real for the new processors. And we had this version of DOS that we had for that we had sold to customers. We had contractual obligations for this thing. And we finished it off. And so I was one of the people who finished that off and helped ship that to Goupil, which is
nice,
a French computer company.
And well, I've had everything from a TRS-80 Model 3 on, so I'm sure I've enjoyed a lot of your hard work over the years.
And very possibly.
What's the latest thing you're working on now?
I'm working on the Windows Runtime team, and we're actually a really small team inside the Developer Experience Division, and our job is to define the tools, patterns, and practices that underlie the Windows Runtime. So we define how the async pattern, our team actually owns the COM, the marshalling infrastructure, the activation infrastructure. We define how the language projections, the data that the language projections use to understand how to show up, how to project the APIs. And then they use the tooling that we create to allow all of the other developers throughout Windows to build the Windows Runtime APIs that all of the Windows App Store app developers use.
Awesome. So. Andrew, what are we going to talk about today?
We're just going to go over general troubleshooting techniques. Larry obviously has a years of experience in how to approach troubles. I've got a different approach from the support ranks, so you get a kind of different story. And we're just going to go over basic steps on how we approach common things, like how would you approach a crash, how you approach a hang, stuff like that. But before we jump into that, I was going to ask you something about the API for WinRT. A lot of it is, well, used to be in COM, co-initialize and co-something, and now everything's row-initialize and row-something. Mm-hmm. So how much legacy, I know you did a lot of COM in your career, how much of COM exists in WinRT, the thinking of it, rather than the code base?
We took a lot of what was really good in COM and carried that forward into the Windows Runtime.
Yeah.
So we kept a lot of really, really, really useful things like the lifetime management infrastructure, the marshalling infrastructure that allows you to get objects from one thread to another. There's actually a talk tomorrow morning with Martin Lovell at 9 a.m. that actually talks about this, and it'll be recorded and you'll be able to watch it on the live, on the web when you see this show. It talks about how the threading infrastructure and the marshalling, how we can transfer calls from one thread. We took a lot of that stuff, but we also said there's a lot of stuff in COM that's kind of broken.
Yeah.
And so we went and we said, okay, well, how do we fix some of the things that are broken in COM? And that was the next thing. And so the Windows Runtime is about fixing a lot of the stuff that's broken and that's really just not pleasant to use.
Mm.
So.
That's cool. You know, I know personally, I coded for 17 years before joining Microsoft. And I coded at the time when COM had no helpers, right? So
yes.
All COM I write, to this day, I do it raw. Mm-hmm. I write my own ad refs and everything else, and I don't rely on ATL or anything. And I think knowing that fundamental has done me very well in able to troubleshoot now.
It's funny, you're absolutely right, because, and we were talking about this earlier, where at some point, you have to know what's going on in the system. You can't rely on just being able to, oh yeah, that's all gonna be reference counted and it's all just gonna magically just work.
Yeah.
Well, that's true until it doesn't work.
Mm.
And then what are you going to do? When are you going to do when you realize that, oh, wait, I used the ampersand operator, and the ampersand operator in this template class library doesn't free up the underlying pointer, but the .get does, or something. Who knows? I mean, there are, you need to understand what's going on, and sometimes you can have really horrible bugs because you don't know what's going on under the covers.
Yeah, you just have to know the fundamentals. That's how everything is.
It's all about the fundamentals. It always has been.
I don't know about you, but have you done much debugging through STL and stuff like that and just scratched your head for, and the CLR too?
Yes.
It's just...
I use a lot of STL code these days, and it's been quite exciting debugging through the STL logic. Stuff gets inlined, and it can be quite a challenge.
Yeah, I have noticed that with the introduction of inlining in Windows 8, it's a whole new world of data available to you, but it's also a whole new world of pain in trying to work out your way through those inline frames.
Yes.
It seems that we inline more than ever before, and I've seen functions which are 3 or 4 or 5 inlines deep, and you just scratch your head going, I have no idea.
Exactly, yeah. It's a real challenge.
Yeah.
And it makes it exciting.
Yeah. So how about the obvious things like crashes? How do you approach a crash if you see one of those in your day-to-day work?
It depends. If it's a test machine, an end user customer, I grab a crash dump and work on it offline because I've got a live customer who's dead. If I'm lucky, I can dig out enough quickly from the crash dump to figure out how to make a reproduction. I'll ask for a reproduction. A lot of the stuff I do these days I own what's called the middle compiler, or the low-level middle compiler. So a lot of it's, when you're compiling this source file, it crashes. Well, can you hand me the source file? And I can and that helps in reproducing the failure. On the other hand, even if you have a crash dump, it is amazing how much information you can pull from a crash dump. I find this funny because I deal with a lot of younger developers, newer developers, and they get a crash dump and they look at the call stack and they say, that was interesting. I can't see how that could possibly have happened. And then they ignore the call stack or the crash dump and they start staring at the code or they start thinking about it. And I'm like, well, no.
The evidence is there.
There's stuff there. There's stuff that's there that you really can tease out about what's happened. You can look at the stack. There's an amazing amount of information left behind about what actually happened that you can just tease out, and it's not always obvious what's going on and what it's obvious, but sometimes it's really easy, but sometimes it's not. You know, I get a crash in some, I've been doing a lot of work in C++, CX, and PPL, and so I get a crash. Actually, this happened the other day. I was debugging some code and PPL crashed with an unhandled exception. Mm-hmm. So if you have a PPL callback, one of the lambdas...
Do you want to explain what PPL is?
Oh, I'm sorry. The Parallel Patterns Library, which is an asynchronous library to make programming async APIs on Windows Runtime much easier. Mm-hmm. And I've been writing a lot of Windows Runtime code in the feature I'm working on. And so I've been doing a lot of work with the Parallel Library. And it's a joy to use, it's wonderful, but one of the things about it is that if you throw an exception and the exception is not handled by some part of the chain, PPL throws or aborts. It has an int 3, it breaks in, and it says, you forgot to handle that exception. Well, okay, how do I debug that? How do you do that? Well, there's an exception object that you actually have, and PPL, there's enough context there. You tease that out, you can find out the exception, you can find where it came from, hopefully, and but it takes some digging, it takes some working at it, but you can figure a lot of that stuff out.
Yeah. Now, I think we've tried to go through that in the WinDBG series on Defrag Tools. Mm-hmm. That's probably something we're going to revisit again. It's one of those experience things versus something training. You need to look at a couple before you kind of...
Oh, you need to do a lot.
More than a couple, yeah.
It's a lot. You need to be... And it's a skill like every other skill.
I think people don't get that.
Rusty. You get rusty at it.
Yeah. I think debugging is a skill as much as coding is a skill.
It is absolutely a skill.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that because I was looking at a couple of crash dumps from external that have been reported back, and I'm realizing that back when I worked on the sound team, I spent a lot of time debugging crash dumps because we'd get crash dumps from customers in the field, and yeah. I'd have to look at them and figure out what the problem was. And I've realized, looking at recent crash dumps, I'm not as good as I used to be at them. Mm. Postmortem debugging is a skill, and it atrophies if you don't use it a lot. Yeah. You have to keep up on it. It's important.
I think coding is the same. Like, I spend my day being a debugger, but my coding skills from the last 20 years have degraded, much like coding.
Very possibly, believe that.
What advice would you give a younger person who doesn't have the 29 years of experience in troubleshooting crashes? And
Troubleshoot crashes?
Just keep doing it.
I mean, you're not going to be good, but I can almost guarantee you there's somebody you work with who is good.
Yeah.
And there's somebody who's done it before. Get that person. Ask them. Help. Ask them for help. Never, never, ever, ever, ever feel afraid to ask for help, because if you don't ask for help, you will get lost. You will lose and you'll fail because you're not going to be able to. I deal with a lot of people who've not been doing it for very long. They're like, oh no, I didn't want to bother you. I didn't want to have to. No, it's okay. Ask. It's okay.
Yeah, because, and that's why we're here. So if you have questions, email us, defragtools@microsoft.com. Yeah. We're happy to help out. So let's talk a little bit about...
Can you explain what this thing is?
This is a Spiro. So this is a device that's being controlled by people back there with a Windows Phone device. And we'll just let it kind of trail around.
And they're doing it because they want to distract us.
Yeah, it's not working, though.
Oh,
yeah. I don't even notice it. It's all right. So let's talk a little bit about ARM. I mean, people are familiar with x86 and x64. Do they need to learn ARM? The fact that you're thinking about it that long.
Well, I haven't. I haven't needed to. I have a bunch of code that I run, that I own, that runs on ARM every day.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is I've not had to. Having said that, a processor is a processor is a processor. Fundamentally, they all do the same things. They all have kind of the same assembly language. And if you know one, you can kind of fake it.
Yeah.
And so, and I haven't seen a processor that I've had to deal with yet that hasn't really kind of, the same techniques work everywhere. If you're dealing with a crash running on the emulator in ARM, it's crashing and you're looking at it in the debugger, and it's the same. Where the stuff is located, where the variables are kept, what register they're in, what are they on the stack, are they in register, those things are all different.
Yeah.
But the problems really aren't typically that different, and the odds are very good. The odds are almost certain that it's in your code. It's not somebody else's code.
Yeah.
That's something I apologize. That's something I always find humorous when somebody, and this happens regularly, somebody comes in and says, I think I found a bug in create thread, or I think I found a bug in create file. Because when I call create file, it access violates when I do, so it AVs when I do this. You know, there's a lot of people calling create thread every single day. I don't think it's create thread or create process or whatever. It's probably something you did that was not quite right.
And
I always find it amazing that everybody assumes, they start with the assumption that it's not their code, and I always find that fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
We were talking about offstage, we're talking about ARM, and we've both coded in non-Intel things. You've done a lot of MIPS.
Yeah.
And I actually started my whole career in Alpha, and I mean, these new CPUs turn up as time goes on, and ARM64 will turn up at some point, and it will look different again. And it's just one of the things that evolves forward, but like you're saying, the fundamentals are there. A CPU does a move, an add, a subtract, a call, and a return, and that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah. On the other hand, it can be really fun on ARM and MIPS, both, I believe, have, they don't have a 32, at least MIPS didn't have a 32-bit indexing mode, so if you ever wanted to access a fixed address in physical memory, or in virtual memory, the effective address had to be created by adding in two numbers. So you'd initialize a value with 1 64-bit, then you'd subtract another value to set the 32-bit register to point to the appropriate location in memory and then indirect through it.
Yeah.
And that got to be really exciting because you, like, hold on. I know that code is accessing a global variable or an array, an entry in a global array. How do I find what the actual address is? And you have to bring up your calculator and try to punch the numbers in to do the math because it's just the register's gone or something, and it's yeah. You know, or I loaded it from this location in memory, and now I'm jumping indirect through it. I need to find out where it went, came from, and it can be really exciting. And so there are times when the processor requirements make things exciting, but usually it's just assembly.
Yeah, I've done a bit of ARM for personal reasons, not for work reasons, and I found it to be pretty close to Intel. I didn't really have to change my thinking much.
Yeah.
And it's not one of those things that's laborious. I think if you know Intel now, you'll jump into ARM within a couple of days.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's not
today. And the beautiful thing is that our compilers are good enough at this point that it's very, very, very rare that you're going to run into a piece of code that works on Intel.
Yeah.
On Intel. That works on x86 and x64 that doesn't work on ARM, which is very fortunate.
Yeah, if you hit an issue, the odds are it's timing related more than actual
Absolutely.
Logic related.
So Absolutely.
Do you need to performance tune x86 separately from ARM?
You know, I had a test case that was failing reliably on ARM. And I looked at it and started looking at it, and I'm like, I went over to my x86 machine and started doing perf analysis on the x86 machine. And I found a whole bunch of places on the x86 machine using the x86 perf toolkits, performance analyzer. And guess what? Found a whole bunch of bottlenecks in my code, fixed them. Problem on ARM went away. Because I don't like saying this, but you know, the ARM is just a slower processor.
Yeah.
It's not as efficient. It's not as fast. It's clocked slower.
By design.
By design. And it's... But everything you see that's slow on the ARM is also slow on a faster processor. You just may not care about it as much.
Yeah.
As I was talking about this earlier, we had the situation in Windows 7 where on certain machines we found that the audio playback was taking a significant percentage of the CPU. And we didn't know why. These were Intel machines, but on certain netbooks, it was taking a huge amount of... We couldn't even do 1080p playback because the audio stack was taking up too much time. Mm-hmm. And we're like, what's going on? Well, it turns out the problem is that a small part of the audio pipeline was using the floating point instruction set. And on the processor on these machines, these x86 machines, on the processor on these machines, the floating point pipeline was extraordinarily slow. And so we recoded that particular part of the pipeline using some of the MMX instructions, the multimedia extensions, and poof, problem went away, and all of a sudden we got seamless 1080p pro.
Yeah.
ARM? No, it's just this processor happened to have something that was not as fast as the other processors, and we didn't notice it because up until this new processor came out, every other machine had a very fast floating point processor, and we just didn't notice it. And ARM is really no different. It's just slower.
The
other thing I've seen in support cases is people complaining about 1080p playback, and it's glitching, or I got what's called iframe mode, which is that every 5 or 10 second frame until it thinks it's fast enough to catch up again and then start playback. And you look at it, and you use Windows Performance Toolkit, and you look at these graphs, and CPU is at 100%, and you go, wow, that's using a lot of grunt, and then... But you have another machine right next to it playing the same clip, and it's on 20%. And you go, how can this be so different? And you do all the analysis of stacks, and they look all the same, and they've got all the same weights. And you go, I don't get it. And then finally, it twigged. I turned on the power subsystem, and the power policy had the thing maxed at 40% or 60%. It would never let the CPU get up to full frequency. The power policy was set so aggressive to keep the battery good for long life, that it hobbled this what inherently was a slow CPU in the first place to a point of ineffectiveness.
Interesting.
So I think it was running like 800 megahertz or 600 megahertz. It was barely ticking over.
Oh my gosh, that's going to be really hard to do full video playback.
It's just not going to do it, right?
Yeah.
And I think for this one, it was only for one codec, which didn't happen to be GPU offloaded, and then that's why it had to be CPU rendered.
Of course.
And that's why it didn't work. And so all the testing they'd done had been on this other file formats that were all GPU offloaded.
Yep.
And they, okay, power policy is good. We can run it this low, increase the battery life by 3 hours.
Yep.
That's good. And then, unfortunately, just one codec came through and
didn't quite work.
Didn't quite work. So, yeah. So how about hangs? How do you approach hangs in your life? I mean, crashes are a bit more deterministic. They're a
crashes
static point
really
in time.
Deterministic. They're yeah. wonderful.
Well, hangs not wonderful.
Okay. Hangs are interesting because hangs come in. There's really only two kinds of hangs that I run into. The first one is you've got some piece of code that's stuck in an infinite loop.
Mm.
And you're going to tell that because your CPU is burning at 100% or one of your cores is burning at 100%. And you break into the debugger and you're going to find where you're at. And those tend to be really pretty straightforward to debug because, the circular, you know, this linked list is supposed to be null terminated is circular.
I find many of those. Do you find many?
Yeah, it happens. Yeah. It does happen. The other ones are deadlocks. And when you're dealing with async programming, it can be a little bit trickier to figure that one out. And let me come back to async in particular. But traditional deadlocks, you have multiple threads. The lovely thing about deadlocks is you almost always have a critical section chain.
Yes.
And you can always find which threads you have, and you can usually get a good call stack.
Yeah.
For each of the threads. And when you've got good call stacks for each of the threads, you look at the code in each of them, and critical sections have to have a hierarchy. Mm. When your own critical section A, and then you go to take critical section B, you always have to take them in the order A, then
and B.
If you ever take them in the order B, then A, you will deadlock. It's not you may deadlock.
At some
point,
you will
deadlock. It's just a question of when. It's going to happen, and you will deadlock.
Yeah. And we have a defrag on that on like episode 13, I want to say.
Yeah.
Around there.
Okay. Yeah. You will deadlock, and it's just a question of finding out where it is, and then you have to figure out how to fix that and work through those issues, and that's a whole other talk that I could go on about.
Yeah.
Async is funky. Async's a challenge because async is you lose causality because you start an async operation and then you return to your UI thread.
Off you go.
And you're off you go. And you got a hung app and you break into the app and you look at it and you say, oh, look, every single thread is doing nothing.
Yeah.
Well, that isn't very helpful. It isn't very useful. And then that's actually why in Windows 8.1, we've added a great deal of work from my team to improve the quality of async debugging. There's a talk by Harry Pearson about where he talks about that, where every time you start an async operation, we leave a piece of evidence behind about where the async operation originated. And then as the async operation is complete, we have this chain of evidence that can be stitched together by a debugger. And the debugger can figure out where the sequence of calls that were made to get to the current spot, so you can actually recreate a call stack.
So is that a new debugger extension, or
it's built into the Visual Studio 2012 debugger?
Yeah.
And I believe there's a WinDBG extension, but I'm not certain about that.
Cool.
So it's all just built into the Visual Studio 2012 or 2013.
So when it comes to async, a lot of the times also is across language barriers as well. I mean, you have some high, you async it off to do some high speed C++ over here from this C# or whatever it is, Java script. Nice Windows Store app. How do you tackle those interrupt world problems?
That's really hard, unfortunately. If you can get to a native language like C++, it's usually pretty straightforward because you're not. It's the same world. If you're dealing with C#, once you're in the C# language code, it's often easy, but it can be very tricky. Resurrecting call stacks across different languages can be quite challenging.
And does projection come into this conversation?
Well, not often, actually. I find that the language projections tend to be really, really thin. Though it is, I've been working with C++ language projection a lot recently, and it can be a little bit tricky. Because the C++ language projection actually creates a class implementation behind every ref object. There's actually a class that implements that with methods that you call, and those methods return the values, and the class implementation is hidden It's assembly. You can only look at it if you're in assembly language. And sometimes you actually have to step through.
That's those inline frames that kill you, yeah.
Yeah, it's just like the inline frames that kill you. And it can be kind of tricky, especially if you're trying to debug the implementation of WinRT API, which we have to do a lot. Mm. Customers often don't, but sometimes
right,
do. But
yeah.
It becomes kind of tricky to trace through the interop experience for C++. And similar, this .NET has similar sometimes challenges there.
I have noticed a lot of the APIs in WinRT, like for example, the devices API that will tell you gyrometer, inclinometer, all those type of things, or things like the ones that will tell you what printers are attached, or all those. A lot of those guys, because you're running in the WinRT bubble, they don't have access to the kernel to ask those questions. And there's a lot of RPC calls over to a SVC host or something else to do the guts. And I know personally, I struggle with working out, am I debugging, camera.exe, or am I debugging the SVC host? I mean, what's the best way of knowing where you should be focusing your efforts when it comes to that type of things?
As a Windows developer trying to debug my Windows component, or as a third-party developer trying to debug?
Well, third-party, because that's about what our audience is.
That's what I figured. Okay. Because if you're a third-party, again, this async stuff that we talked about, one of the really, really wonderful things about this async stuff is we actually chain through calls to remote processes and back.
That's cool.
So we put a lot of work into this to make sure it worked exactly right. So if you actually have a call that runs in a broker that runs out of your process, and the async call is in another process, you can actually find that, and you can actually trace back that call and find out, we've called that into camera.exe or what device broker or whatever broker it is that's currently outstanding in. So you can actually track that through and find out if a call, so if you've got a call that goes out to a broker and then comes back to your process and you're in a completion callback or a filter or something like that, you actually can watch and the call stack will actually reflect that.
So that's kind of a logic approach. What happens if you're tracking down a memory leak? Can you take the same approach and look across processes for memory leaks, or is it not really the same way of approaching it?
Memory leaks are a little trickier because the thing to keep in mind, though, about a memory leak is that if you're dealing with cross-process environment, you have a proxy, and then there's an implementation on the server. The client side has a proxy. The proxies are very small. But if you realize that your application is leaking objects in a broker, you're also leaking objects on your client.
Yeah.
And so the same techniques you do to detect client side leaks.
So you fix the pointer ref over here, and that will
and that hopefully will fix the reference on the other side. And
cool.
So historically, most apps have been synchronous. In this new asynchronous world, what skills do developers need to develop?
That's a really good question.
Well, do you need to know how it translates into a fundamental still? It seems there's so much more abstraction now. That before, if you wrote a for loop, you kind of could visualize the assembler. Mm-hmm. But you can't really do that anymore, right?
It's tricky. It's harder. It is harder.
Yeah.
Any kind of parallel environment, like PPL, any type of asynchronous environment that, like, well, and we have this for JavaScript, we have this for C# with the await keyword. They're all highly asynchronous, and it can be really challenging. I'm actually a big fan of printf debugging.
Yeah.
I write ETW events using the event logging APIs to a debug channel. I write, output debug string onto the debugger.
Yeah.
I do a lot of that. I write to files. I write to log files. I am a huge fan of debugging that way. And what I find is that if I, for multi-threaded and asynchronous debugging, that's invaluable because I can then look at the timestamp, look at the threads that originated the request, and then build a model in my head of what happened, where I was, when was I, what thread was I running on. And then you stitch the pieces together, and all of a sudden, by the time you're done, you figured out how you got from where you were to where you are.
Yeah.
And even when you're dealing with hangs, if you've got a heavily async, if you've got logs, traces, you know where you were, or at least you know close to where you stopped.
There's some context.
You've got context, and I debug with print by printf a lot.
I think a lot of teams have taken that approach now. I mean, I know particularly the store team itself, their logging is phenomenally good. And I always forget the path, but something like local Microsoft store something, AC, Tampa something. And the file in there is fantastic. You know, you go, why isn't my app installing? Look at the log. Yeah. Now, I've never had to debug the store yet because the logs have been enough.
Well, actually, you don't even have to look at the text logs. If you actually look at the app deployment event logs in the event viewer, there are some really amazingly useful events. Just in the standard Windows event viewer, you bring it up. Under there, you just go down into the application deployment.
But the, under the Microsoft area.
What, in the Microsoft area, yeah. In the new ETW log. There are some really good, useful information. I've been dealing, I spent a bunch of time, part of this, the feature we're delivering as part of 8.1 has some code that's run as part of the deployment process. And so I had to spend a lot of time debugging deployment bugs and problems with my code. And it was invaluable because there's a lot of information that's actually already logged by the system that you can use. And this gets back to the, you know, teasing out stuff. We log a lot of stuff. Mm. And it's almost all of it's available, and you can just go into the event log and look, and it's there. It's great.
I think the event viewer is one is the number one tool overlooked by everybody who troubleshoots.
Yes, I'm
guilty of it myself. I'm not going to throw stones, but yeah, it is a gold mine.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. Cool.
So I think we're out of time. Thank you for joining us, Larry.
I loved it. It was appreciated.
Awesome. Thank you for being here. And so that's the show for this week. If you have questions, email us at defragtools@microsoft.com. We'll see you next week.
Have a week.